which described repeated corrupt behavior by officials of the Italian Secret Service Agency SISMI, including the forgery and planting of documents. These officials were also charged with involvement in a cover-up of the agents carrying out the 1980 Bologna Railway Station massacre, the kind of terrorist connection that attracts frenetic mass media attention when attributable to suitable villains. As we noted earlier, SISMI officials had visited Aja in prison, and SISMI had issued a forged document implicating the Soviet Union in the shooting of the Pope on May 19, 1981, only 6 days after the assassination attempt. This forgery was never mentioned in the Times, Time, and Newsweek, or on CBS News, and the July 1985 court decision was barely mentioned in a back-page article of the Times. These blackouts are of materials that suggest a corrupt Italian process and the possibility that Aja was persuaded and coached to pin the plot on the East. A propaganda system exploiting the alleged Bulgarian connection will naturally avoid such documents. Aja's extremely loose prison conditions and the numerous claims in the Italian and dissident U.S. press of visits by Italian intelligence personnel were also virtually unmentioned by the U.S. mass media throughout 1982 and 1983. In June 1983, Diana Johnstone, the foreign editor of the newspaper In These Times, submitted an op-ed column to the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer that summarized the evidence and claims of intelligence agency visits, the reported threats to Aja that his open and pleasant prison conditions might be terminated if he remained uncooperative, and Martella's proposed deal with Aja. This op-ed offering was rejected, and no commentary or news along these lines was permitted to surface in the Times or the Philadelphia Inquirer, or elsewhere to our knowledge. Several years later, in an article in the New York Times of June 17, 1985, referring to Pandicho's detailed description of how Aja was coached in prison, John Tagliabue describes Aja's prison as notoriously porous, but the Times had never mentioned this notorious fact before or considered it in any way relevant to the case. When Aja identified the Bulgarians in November 1982, the integrity of the Italian investigative judicial process in pursuing the case was already badly compromised for a wide variety of reasons, but the U.S. mass media weren't interested. Nor were they interested in the strange circumstances of the famous Antonov photo, widely circulated in the Western press, which shows Antonov very clearly and in a remarkable likeness watching the scene at St. Peter's Square on May 13, 1981. This photo, Martella eventually claimed, was not of Antonov, but an American tourist. But this tourist, who apparently looked exactly like Antonov, has never been located, and the film from which this shot was taken has unaccountably disappeared. Aja's alterations in his claims about the Bulgarians, with Martella generously allowing him to change his recollections about the timing of events on May 13th, whenever Bulgarian counter-evidence was too strong, failed to attract the media's attention. Aja's June 28, 1983 retraction of his claim that he had visited Antonov's apartment and met his family was not mentioned in the mass media until a full year after the event, and even then suggested to the press no very serious problems with the case or with Martella's investigative work. How could Aja know details about Antonov's apartment if he had never been there? An honest press would have pursued this relentlessly. The New York Times, with Sterling as its reporter, suppressed the issue. The rest of the press simply wasn't interested. The media also weren't interested in Orson Oyman's findings that the Vatican had gone to some pains to try to implicate the Bulgarians, or the trial disclosure that the West German authorities had tried to bribe Grey Wolves member Oral Celik to come to West Germany and confirm Aja's claims. Pandicho's and Paciencia's insider claims of Mafia and SISMI involvement in getting Aja to talk were also given only the slightest attention, and this accumulating mass of materials on the Italian process was never brought together for reassessment. Perhaps the most blatant case of willful ignorance concerned the Italian fixer and former member of SISMI, Francesco Paciencia. Wanted for several crimes, Paciencia had fled Italy, and in 1985 he resided in exile in New York City. Eventually, he was seized and held there by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Pacienza had been a partner of Michael Ledeen in the Billygate affair in Italy and retained his connection after Ledeen became General Haig's right-hand man in Italy in the early days of the Reagan presidency. Pacienza had also been a close associate of Sesame head Giuseppe Santovito. From 1983 onward, it was alleged in the Italian press that Pacienza had been involved in getting Aja to talk, and he himself eventually made detailed accusations of coaching by elements of Sesame. Although Pacienza was readily available for interviews in a New York City jail, the New York Times ignored him. Our hypothesis is that they did this because if they had talked to him, it would have been difficult to avoid discussing his connections with Ledeen and Sterling, both Time sources and under Time's protection. This would not have reflected well on the quality of the paper's sourcing. Pacienza's story would also have highlighted the Times suppression of facts concerning the corruption of Sesame and raised questions about coaching. This would have disturbed the propaganda line. The trial in Rome was awkward for the Western media, as Aja quickly declared himself to be Jesus and, more important, failed to produce any supportive evidence backing up his claims of Bulgarian involvement. The diligent and extensive court investigation found numerous gray wolves links to Aja in the period just up to his assassination attempt, but no witness to his allegedly numerous meetings with Bulgarians in Rome, no money, no car, and in the end, no conviction. As we have pointed out, in addition to the already available evidence of atrocious prison practice in dealing with Aja and the 1981 meetings with intelligence officials and Martella's offer, there was a steady accumulation of claims and evidence of pressures on Aja to implicate the Bulgarians. But despite this evidence and the failure to convict the Bulgarians after a lengthy investigation and trial, the mass media of the West never provided any serious reevaluations of the case. Almost uniformly, they hid behind the fact that an Italian court dismissed the case for lack of evidence rather than demonstrated innocence. They never hinted at the possibility that an Italian court and jury might still be biased against the Eastern Bloc and protective of the powerful Western interests that had supported the Bulgarian connection so energetically. The mass media also never looked back at their own earlier claims and those of disinformationists to see how they had stood up to the test of accumulated evidence. On January 3, 1983, Newsweek had quoted an Italian official who said that, "We have substantial evidence that Aja operated in close contact with the Bulgarians," and the New York Times editorialized on October 20, 1984, that Aja's accounts of meetings with Bulgarian officials are verifiable in important details. If there was substantial evidence and verifiable details long before the trial, why was this evidence not produced in the courtroom? Why, after enormous further investigative effort, was there still not enough evidence to sustain a conviction? The U.S. mass media didn't even try to answer these questions. This would mean asking serious questions about the validity of the SHK model and considering alternatives, which the media have never been prepared to do. For them, the alternative model, plausible from the beginning and, by March 1986, based on a great deal of evidence, was still the Bulgarian view. The questions raised by the Bulgarian view, we believe, would have been applied by the U.S. mass media to analogous facts in a Moscow setting. This means that the view actually employed by the media from beginning to end was a U.S. government view, as suggested by a propaganda model. Chapter 5. The Indochina Wars. 1. Vietnam. Media coverage of the U.S. wars in Indochina had engendered a good deal of bitter controversy, some close analysis of several specific incidents, and a few general studies. It is widely held that the media lost the war by exposing the general population to its horrors and by unfair, incompetent, and biased coverage reflecting the adversary culture of the 60s. The media's reporting of the Tet Offensive has served as the prime example of this hostility to established power, which, it has been argued, undermines democratic institutions and should be curbed, either by the media themselves or by the state. A propaganda model leads to different expectations. on its assumptions, we would expect media coverage and interpretation of the war to take for granted that the United States intervened in the service of generous ideals, with the goal of defending South Vietnam from aggression and terrorism, and in the interest of democracy and self-determination. With regard to the second-level debate on the performance of the media, a propaganda model leads us to expect that there would be no condemnation of the media for uncritical acceptance of the doctrine of U.S. benevolence and for adherence to the official line on all central issues, or even awareness of these characteristics of media performance. Rather, given that the U.S. government did not attain all its objectives in Indochina, the issue would be whether the media are to be faulted for undermining the noble cause by adopting too adversarial a stance and departing thereby from fairness and objectivity. We shall find out that all of these expectations are amply fulfilled. 5.1. The Bounds of Controversy. For the first time in history, Robert Elegant writes, the outcome of a war was determined not in the battlefield, but on the printed page, and above all, on the television screen, leading to the defeat of the United States in Vietnam. The belief that the media, particularly television, were responsible for U.S. government failures is widely expressed. It was endorsed by the right-wing media monitoring organization Accuracy in Media in its hour-long Vietnam op-ed, aired by public television in response to its own 13-part series on the war. According to a more moderate expression of this view, the media had become a notable new source of national power by 1970 as part of a general excess of democracy, contributing to the reduction of governmental authority at home and a resulting decline in the influence of democracy abroad. Broader interests of society and government require that if journalists do not impose standards of professionalism, the alternative could well be regulation by the government to the end of restoring a balance between government and media. Freedom House Executive Director Leonard Sussman commented on Big Story, the study of media coverage of the Tet Offensive sponsored by Freedom House, describes the adversarial aspect of the press-government relation as normal, presupposing without argument that it has been demonstrated, but asks, must free institutions be overthrown because of the very freedom they sustain? John Rosch proceeds further still, calling for congressional investigation of the workings of these private governments who distorted the record in pursuit of their anti-Johnson mission, although he fears Congress is too terrified of the media and their awesome power to take on this necessary task. New York Times television critic John Corey defends the media as merely unmindful, not unpatriotic, as the harsher critics claim. They are not anti-American, despite their adversarial stance. Rather, they reflect a powerful element of the journalistic literary political culture where the left wins battles by default because its ideas make up the moral and intellectual framework for a large part of the culture, and television becomes an accomplice of the left when it allows the culture to influence its news judgments, as in his view it regularly does. Media spokespersons, meanwhile, defend their commitment to independence while conceding that they may err through excessive zeal in calling the government to account in vigorous pursuit of their role as watchdog. Within the mainstream, the debate is largely framed within the bounds illustrated by the PBS AIM interchange broadcast on the public television network. AIM's Vietnam op-ed accused PBS of deliberate misrepresentation and other sins, while the producers of the documentary defended its accuracy. A dozen commentators, ranging from extreme hawks to mild critics of the war, such as General Douglas Kennard, added their thoughts. The program concluded with the studio wrap-up featuring three intelligent citizens, Colonel Harry Summers of the Army War College, a hawkish critic of the tactics of the war, Peter Braestrup, one of the harshest critics of media war coverage, and Huynh Son Thong, speaking for what the moderator called the South Vietnamese community, meaning the exile community. The hypothesis advanced by the propaganda model, excluded from the debate as unthinkable, is that in dealing with the American wars in Indochina, the media were indeed unmindful, but highly patriotic in the special and misleading sense that they kept and keep closely to the perspective of official Washington and the closely related corporate elite, in conformity to the general journalistic, literary, political culture from which the left, meaning dissident opinion that questions jingoistic assumptions, is virtually excluded. The propaganda model predicts that this should be generally true not only of the choice of topics covered and the way they are covered, but also, and far more crucially, of the general background of presuppositions within which the issues are framed and the news presented. Insofar as there is debate among dominant elites, it will be reflected within the media, which in this narrow sense may adopt an adversarial stance with regard to those holding office, reflecting elite dissatisfaction with current policy. Otherwise, the media will depart from the elite consensus only rarely and in limited ways. Even when large parts of the general public break free of the premises of the doctrinal system, as finally happened during the Indochina Wars, real understanding based upon an alternative conception of the evolving history can be developed only with considerable effort by the most diligent and skeptical. And such understanding as can be reached through serious and often individual effort will be difficult to sustain or even apply elsewhere, an extremely important matter for those who are truly concerned with democracy at home and the influence of democracy abroad, in the real sense of these words. These conclusions concerning media conformism are accepted in part by mainstream critics of the media. Thus, Leonard Sussman, of Freedom House, observes that U.S. intervention in 1965 enjoyed near-total editorial support. The intervention in 1965 included the deployment of U.S. combat forces in Vietnam, the regular bombing of North Vietnam, and the bombing of South Vietnam at triple the scale in a program of unlimited aerial warfare inside the country at the price of literally pounding the place to bits. It is a highly significant fact that neither then nor before was there any detectable questioning of the righteousness of the American cause in Vietnam, or of the necessity to proceed to full-scale intervention. By that time, of course, only questions of tactics and costs remained open, and further discussion in the mainstream media was largely limited to these narrow issues. While dissent and domestic controversy became a focus of media coverage from 1965, the actual views of dissidents and resistors were virtually excluded. These individuals were presented primarily as a threat to order, and while their tactics might be discussed, their views were not. The anti-war movement stood at the bottom of the media's hierarchy of legitimate political actors. Daniel Hallin concludes from his survey of television coverage, the print media were hardly different, and its access to the news and influence over it were still more limited. All exactly as the propaganda model predicts. As the war progressed, elite opinion gradually shifted to the belief that the U.S. intervention was a tragic mistake that was proving too costly, thus enlarging the domain of debate to include a range of tactical questions hitherto excluded. Expressible opinion in the media broadened to accommodate these judgments, but the righteousness of the cause and nobility of intent were rarely subject to question. Rather, editorials explained that the idealistic motives of the political and military commands who conceived their role quite honestly as that of liberators and allies in the cause of freedom had little chance to prevail against local leaders skilled in the art of manipulating their foreign protectors. Our Vietnamese were too corrupt and were too weak and too naive to resist their manipulations, while their Vietnamese were too wily and vicious. How could American idealism cope with such unfavorable conditions? At the war's end, the liberal media could voice the lament that the high hopes and wishful idealism with which the American nation had been born had been chastened by the failure of America to work its will in Indochina. But no conflict can be perceived between wishful idealism and the commitment to work our will in foreign lands, a comment that holds of the culture more broadly. As for direct reporting, the major charge of the influential Freedom House study of the Tet Offensive, echoed by others who condemn the media for their overly adversarial stance, is that reporting was too pessimistic. We return to the facts, but consideration of the logic of the charge shows that even if accurate, it would be quite consistent with a propaganda model. There was no doubt increased pessimism within the German General Staff after Stalingrad. Similarly, Soviet elites openly expressed concern over the wisdom of the defense of Afghanistan and its costs, and some might have been overly pessimistic about the likelihood of success in this endeavor. But in neither case do we interpret these reactions as a departure from service to the national cause, as defined by the state authorities. The Freedom House charge tacitly but clearly presupposes that the media must not only accept the framework of government propaganda, but must be upbeat and enthusiastic about the prospects for success in a cause that is assumed without discussion to be honorable and just. This basic assumption endures throughout and provides the basic framework for discussion and news reports. The harshest critics within the mainstream media, as well as what Corey calls the culture, held that the war began with blundering efforts to do good, although by 1969, that is, a year after corporate America had largely concluded that this enterprise should be liquidated, it had become clear to most of the world and most Americans that the intervention had been a disastrous mistake, and that it was a delusion to attempt to build a nation on the American model in South Vietnam. The argument against the war was that the United States had misunderstood the cultural and political forces at work in Indochina, that it was in a position where it could not impose a solution except at a price too costly to itself. Anthony Lewis. Stanley Karnow's highly praised companion volume to the PBS television series describes the American war as a failed crusade undertaken for aims that were noble, although illusory, and motivated by the loftiest intentions, specifically, the commitment to defend South Vietnam's independence. Within the culture, it would be difficult to find harsher critics of U.S. Asia policy than John King Fairbank, the Dean of American China Scholarship, or Harvard Government Professor Stanley Hoffman, or dissent editor Irving Howe. In his presidential address to the American Historical Association in December 1968, Fairbank characterized the U.S. involvement, which he termed a disaster, as the result of an excess of righteousness and disinterested benevolence, an error based on misunderstanding. Howe explained that we opposed the war because we believed, as Stanley Hoffman has written, that Washington could save the people of South Vietnam and Cambodia from communism only at a cost that made a mockery of the word save. Hoffman explains later that our efforts in supporting the South Vietnamese were undermined by the way the war was fought, while the means adopted to deter the North Vietnamese from further infiltration were never sufficient, and sufficient means, had the United States been willing to commit them, would have created for the United States real external dangers with potential adversaries and in relations with allies. Again, we find not the slightest recognition that the familiar pieties of state propaganda might be subject to some question. In its 1985 10th anniversary retrospective on the Vietnam War, Foreign Affairs presented both the hawk and the dove positions. Representing the more dovish view, Dave Fromkin and James Chase assert without argument that the American decision to intervene in Indochina was predicated on the view that the United States has a duty to look beyond its purely national interests and that, pursuant to its global responsibilities, the United States must serve the interests of mankind. As a moral matter, we were right to choose the lesser of two evils and to oppose communist aggression by the Vietnamese in Vietnam, but on the practical side, it was wrong because our side was likely to lose. The moral imperatives of our service to the interests of mankind do not, however, require that we intervene to overthrow governments that are slaughtering their own populations, such as the Indonesian government we supported in 1965, or our Guatemalan and Salvadoran clients of the 1980s. On the contrary, they observe the success of our Indonesian allies in destroying the domestic political opposition by violence in 1965 was a respectable achievement that should have led us to reconsider our Vietnam policy. They cite Lyndon Johnson's national security advisor, McGeorge Bundy, who feels in retrospect that our effort in Vietnam was excessive after 1965, when a new anti-communist government took power in Indonesia and destroyed the Communist Party, the only mass-based political party in that country, incidentally slaughtering several hundred thousand people, mostly landless peasants, and thus securing Indonesia in accord with our global responsibilities and serving the interests of mankind. Fromkin and Chase define opponents of the war, meaning presumably critics whose views merit serious consideration, as those who did not believe that whipping the enemy, North Vietnam, was enough so long as the enemy refused to submit or surrender. The media, they say, brought home to the American people how little effective control over the population had been purchased by all of General Westmoreland's victories, thus strengthening the opponents of the war dissatisfied by our inability to gain effective control over the population. The media cannot be blamed for pointing out the problem, and if General Westmoreland knew the answer to it, perhaps he should have revealed it to the public. Outside of those committed to the cause, although possibly skeptical about its feasibility or the means employed, there are only those whom McGeorge Bundy once described as wild men in the wings, referring to people who dared to question the decisions of the first team that was determining U.S. policy in Vietnam. Quite generally, insofar as the debate over the war could reach the mainstream during the war or since, it was bounded on the one side by the hawks, who felt that with sufficient dedication the United States could succeed in defending South Vietnam, controlling the population, and thus establishing American-style democracy there, and on the other side by the doves, who doubted that success could be achieved in these noble aims at reasonable cost. Later, there arrived the owls, who observed the proceedings judiciously without succumbing to the illusions of either extreme of this wrenching controversy. Reporting and interpretation of the facts were framed in accordance with these principles. 5.2. The Wild Men in the Wings. As the elite consensus eroded in the late 1960s, criticism of the noble cause on grounds of its lack of success became more acceptable, and the category of wild men in the wings narrowed to those who opposed the war on grounds of principle, the same grounds on which they opposed the Soviet invasion of Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and later Afghanistan. Let us consider how superpower intervention would be presented from a point of view that permits aggression to be understood as aggression. In the case of the Soviet intervention, there is no serious controversy. True, the Soviet Union has security concerns in Eastern Europe, including states that collaborated with the Nazis in an attack on the Soviet Union that practically destroyed it a generation ago, and now serve as a buffer to a rearmed West Germany that is part of a hostile and threatening military alliance. True, Afghanistan borders areas of the Soviet Union where the population could be inflamed by a radical Islamic fundamentalist revival, and the rebels, openly supported by bitter enemies of the Soviet Union, are undoubtedly terrorists committed to harsh oppression and religious fanaticism who carry out violent acts inside the Soviet Union itself and have been attacking Afghanistan from Pakistani bases since 1973, 6 years before the Soviet invasion. But none of these complexities bear on the fact that the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Afghanistan, holds Poland in a firm grip, etc. True, the Russians were invited into Afghanistan in 1979, but as the London Economist accurately observed, an invader is an invader unless invited in by a government with some claim to legitimacy, and the government that the Soviet Union installed to invite it in plainly lacked any such claim. None of these matters elicit serious controversy, nor should they. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, like earlier cases of Soviet intervention in the region occupied by the Red Army as it drove out the Nazis during World War II, are described as aggression. And the facts are reported in these terms. The United Nations has repeatedly condemned the Soviet aggression in Afghanistan and regularly investigates and denounces the crimes they have committed. Western reporters cover the war from the standpoint of the rebels defending their country from foreign attack, entering Afghanistan with them from their Pakistani sanctuaries. Official Soviet pronouncements are treated not merely with skepticism, but with disdain. In the case of the U.S. intervention in Indochina, no such interpretation has ever been conceivable, apart from the wild men in the wings, although it is at least as well-grounded as the standard and obviously correct interpretation of the Soviet aggression in Afghanistan. Furthermore, the reporting practice of journalists and commentators is also radically different in the two cases. We put off for a moment the more significant issue of how the war is understood, focusing first on the narrower question of journalistic practice. In sharp contrast to the Soviet aggression, It was standard practice throughout the Indochina War for journalists to report Washington pronouncements as fact, even in the extreme case when official statements were known to be false. Furthermore, this practice persisted through the period when the media had allegedly become a notable news source of national power, threatening government authority. To mention only one typical case from the year in which we are to understand this status had been definitely attained, in March 1970, the media reported a North Vietnamese invasion of Laos on the basis of a speech by President Nixon announcing that North Vietnamese forces in Laos had suddenly risen from 50,000 to 67,000. Nixon's comment came immediately after the U.S. military attaché in Vientiane had presented his standard briefing citing the lower figure, a source of much private amusement among the press corps in Vientiane, as one of us witnessed at first hand. But the presidential fabrication was reported as fact. The lower figure was also fraudulent, although this fact was never reported. Throughout the Indochina Wars, when official statements were questioned, it was generally on the basis of U.S. military sources in the field, so that reporting and analysis remained well within the bounds set by U.S. power. Only very rarely did U.S. reporters make any effort to see the war from the point of view of the enemy, the peasants of South Vietnam, Laos, or later Cambodia, or to accompany the military forces of the enemy resisting the U.S. assault. Such evidence as was available was ignored or dismissed. In reporting the war in Afghanistan, it is considered essential and proper to observe it from the standpoint of the victims. In the case of Indochina, it was the American invaders who were regarded as the victims of the aggression of the Vietnamese, and the war was reported from their point of view, just as subsequent commentary, including cinema, views the war from this perspective. Refugee testimony, which could have provided much insight into the nature of the war, was also regularly ignored. The enemy of the U.S. government was the enemy of the press, which could not even refer to them by their own name, yet they were the Viet Cong, a derogatory term of U.S. Saigon propaganda, not the National Liberation Front, a phrase never used without quotation marks by American reporters, who regularly referred to communist aggression, E.W. Kenworthy, by the South Vietnamese in South Vietnam and communist efforts to subvert this country, David Halberstam, their country, then under the rule of a U.S.-imposed client regime. To a substantial extent, the war was reported from Washington. In late 1970, when the process of elite defection was well underway, Los Angeles Times Washington correspondent Jules Witkover described the Washington scene during the earlier years. While the press corps in those years diligently reported what the government said about Vietnam and questioned the inconsistencies as they arose, too few sought out opposing viewpoints and expertise until too late, when events and the prominence of the Vietnam dissent could no longer be ignored. In coverage of the war, the press corps' job narrowed down to three basic tasks: reporting what the government said, finding out whether it was true, and assessing whether the policy enunciated worked. The group did a highly professional job on the first task, but it fell down on the second and third, and there is strong evidence the reason is too many reporters sought the answers in all three categories from the same basic source, the government. The search for opposing viewpoints as things went wrong was also extremely narrow, limited to the domain of tactics, that is, limited to the question of whether the policy enunciated worked. Viewed entirely from the standpoint of U.S. interests and with official premises taken as given. Furthermore, the U.S. war was openly supported by U.S. allies, some of whom sent combat forces, Australia, Thailand, South Korea, while others enriched themselves through their participation in the destruction of Indochina. For Japan and South Korea, this participation contributed significantly to their takeoff to the status of major economic powers, while Canada and Western Europe also profited from their support for the U.S. operations. In contrast to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the United Nations never condemned the U.S. intervention, nor did it investigate or denounce the crimes committed in the course of U.S. military operations, a reflection of U.S. world power and influence. These facts notwithstanding, it is common practice to denounce the U.N. and world opinion for its double standard in condemning the U.S. intervention in defense of South Vietnam, while ignoring the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, regularly described as genocidal, a term never used in the mainstream media with regard to the United States and Indochina. At the time of the full-scale U.S. invasion of Vietnam in 1965, when there was as yet no debate over the righteousness of the already massive intervention, the United States had not yet succeeded in establishing a government able or willing to invite it in. It appears that the United States simply moved in without even the formalities of request or acquiescence by a supposedly sovereign government. Nevertheless, at the dovish extreme of U.S. journalism, Tom Wicker, explaining his view that the United States has no historic or God-given mission to bring democracy to other nations, observes that the matter is different in the case of the maintenance of freedom where it already exists. U.S. support for a democratic regime that is being attacked or subverted by repressive forces of the left or right might well be justified if invited. Although, as in Vietnam, the freedom being defended may be minimal and the cost may be astronomical. As a dissident commentator, Wicker recognizes that the freedom we were defending in Vietnam was minimal and that the cost proved too high. But the doctrine that we were invited in remains sacrosanct, and the idea that we were defending nothing beyond our right to impose our will by violence is completely beyond the range of the thinkable. We might ask how we would characterize the Soviet media if the harshest condemnation of the war in Afghanistan that could be expressed in the year 2000 is that Soviet support for the democratic regime in Afghanistan that invited the Russians in might be justified, although the freedom that the Soviets were defending was perhaps minimal and the cost was far too high. Let us now turn to the wild men in the wings, who adopt the principles universally accepted in the case of Soviet aggression when they approach the U.S. wars in Indochina. The basic facts are not in doubt. By the late 1940s, U.S. authorities took for granted that the backing of France's effort to reconquer its Indochina colonies after World War II, they were opposing the forces of Vietnamese nationalism represented by the Viet Minh, led by Ho Chi Minh. In 1947, the State Department noted that Ho had established himself as the symbol of nationalism and the struggle for freedom to the overwhelming majority of the population. By September 1948, the department deplored our inability to suggest any practicable solution of the Indochina problem in the light of the unpleasant fact that Communist Ho Chi Minh is the strongest and perhaps the ablest figure in Indochina, and that any suggested solution which excludes him is an expedient of uncertain outcome. The Communists, under Ho, having captured control of the nationalist movement, while the U.S. long-term objective was to eliminate so far as possible Communist influence in Indochina. Nonetheless, the United States supported the cause of France against Vietnam, covering some 80% of the cost of the war at the end and contemplating a direct U.S. attack had France agreed. When the French withdrew in 1954, the United States at once turned to the task of subverting the Geneva agreements that laid the groundwork for unification of Vietnam with countrywide elections by 1956, establishing a client state in South Vietnam, the GVN, that controlled its population with substantial violence, and rejected the terms of the Geneva political settlement with U.S. support. State terrorism evoked renewed resistance, and by 1959, Viet Minh cadres in the South, who were being decimated by U.S. organized state terror, received authorization to use violence in self-defense, threatening the quick collapse of the U.S.-imposed regime, which by then had killed tens of thousands of people and alienated much of the peasantry, as well as urban elites. The Vietnam correspondent for the London Times and The Economist, David Hotham, wrote in 1959 that the Diem regime imposed by the United States has crushed all opposition of every kind, however anti-communist it might be. He has been able to do this simply and solely because of the massive dollar aid he has had from across the Pacific, which kept in power a man who, by all the laws of human and political affairs, would long ago have fallen. Diem's main supporters are to be found in North America, not in free Vietnam. The leading U.S. government specialist on Vietnamese communism, Douglas Pike, whose denunciations of the Viet Cong often reached the level of hysteria, conceded that the NLF maintained that its contest with the GVN and the United States should be fought out at the political level, and that the use of massed military might was in itself illegitimate, until forced by the United States and its clients to use counterforce to survive. The Kennedy administration escalated the war in South Vietnam, engaging U.S. military forces directly in bombing, defoliation, and advising combat troops from 1961 to 1962 as part of an effort to drive several million people into concentration camps, strategic hamlets in which they could be protected behind barbed wire and armed guard from the guerrillas whom, the United States conceded, they were willingly supporting. Douglas Pike assessed indigenous support for the NLF at about 50% of the population at the time, which is more than George Washington could have claimed, while the United States could rally virtually no indigenous support. He explained that political options were hopeless, since the NLF was the only truly mass-based political party in South Vietnam, and no one, with the possible exception of the Buddhists, thought themselves equal in size and power to risk entering a coalition, fearing that if they did, the whale, the NLF, would swallow the minnow. As for the Buddhists, the United States regarded them as equivalent to card-carrying communists, Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, and later backed the use of force to destroy their political movement to ensure that no independent political force would remain, since no such force could be controlled. In a highly regarded military history and moral tract in justification of the American war, Gunter Levy describes the purpose of the U.S. air operations of the early 1960s, which involved indiscriminate killing and took a heavy toll of essentially innocent men, women, and children, in a manner that Orwell would have appreciated. Villages in open zones were subjected to random bombardment by artillery and aircraft so as to drive the inhabitants into the safety of the strategic hamlets. It was conceded on all sides that the government imposed by the United States lacked any significant popular support. The experienced U.S. pacification chief John Paul Vann, widely regarded as the U.S. official most knowledgeable about the situation in South Vietnam, wrote in 1965 that a popular political base for the government of South Vietnam does not now exist. The existing government is oriented toward the exploitation of the rural and lower class urban populations. It is, in fact, a continuation of the French colonial system of government, with upper-class Vietnamese replacing the French. The dissatisfaction of the agrarian population is expressed largely through alliance with the NLF. Virtually all parties concerned, apart from the United States, were making serious efforts in the early 1960s to avoid an impending war by neutralizing South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. The official stand of the National Liberation Front, the Viet Cong of U.S. propaganda, essentially the southern branch of the Viet Minh. But the United States was committed to preventing any political settlement. Unable to develop any political base in the South, the U.S. government proceeded to expand the war. It was able to do this by continually manipulating the political scene in South Vietnam to assure the attainment of its objective— continued fighting until an anti-communist regime susceptible to American will was established in the South. Ambassador Lodge observed in January 1964 that it is obvious that the generals are all we have got, and we would keep replacing them until we got the right ones, right meaning that they were willing to follow orders and fight, not negotiate. One of Diem's early replacements told newsmen that he found out that he was going to be the next head of state only when his U.S. advisor told me that the coup d'etat was planned in Saigon and that I was to become president. General Maxwell Taylor spoke quite frankly about the need of establishing some reasonably satisfactory government, replacing it if we are not satisfied either with civilians or with a military dictatorship. It should be noted in this connection that after the long-standing U.S. manipulation of governments in its client state had finally succeeded in its aim, and the United States had placed in power the two former French collaborators, Key and Thieu, whose sole qualifications for rule was that they met the U.S. condition of willingness to fight and evaded political settlement, the U.S. media continued to pretend that the government of South Vietnam was a free choice of the South Vietnamese people. Thus, the New York Times commented editorially on June 4, 1966, that Washington cannot shape the political future in Saigon, but it can continue to urge a search for unity among the South Vietnamese political factions pending the September elections. In fact, the rulers at the moment had been imposed by the United States. The election was a U.S. idea, And, needless to say, the South Vietnamese, who constituted the only truly mass-based political party in South Vietnam, PAIGC, referring to the NLF, were not considered one of the South Vietnamese political factions. As for the unity sought by the United States, it was intended solely to provide a base for prosecution of the U.S. war, as that goal could be accomplished only by suppression of all popular movements. Later in 1966, the military junta, with U.S. approval and direct assistance, crushed by force the largest non-communist group, the Organized Buddhists, thereby clearing the ground for durable rule by Thieu and Ky. Despite all of this, the U.S. media did not point out that any basis for a free election had been destroyed, and that the unelected government was maintained in power solely because its aims were identical to those of the U.S. administration, that is, that it was a classic example of a puppet government. On the contrary, the junta never ceased to be the leaders of free and independent South Vietnam, the word puppet being reserved for agents of enemy states. Returning to the expanding U.S. war, efforts to obtain congressional support succeeded with the August 7, 1964 resolution after the Tonkin Gulf incident, authorizing the president to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression by the Vietnamese in Vietnam, a virtual blank check in waging the war for the administration. The United States invaded outright in early 1965, although initiating the regular bombing of North Vietnam in the hope that Hanoi would use its influence to call off the Southern resistance and to justify the escalation of the attack against the South, which required something beyond the internal aggression by the NLF within South Vietnam that UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson identified as the problem we faced. By the time of the U.S. land invasion in 1965, over 150,000 people had been killed in South Vietnam, according to figures cited by Bernard Fall, most of them under the crushing weight of American armor, napalm, jet bombers, and finally vomiting gases, or victim of the state terrorism of the U.S.-installed regimes. From January 1965, the United States also employed Korean mercenaries, some 300,000 in all, who carried out brutal atrocities in the South. The first regular North Vietnamese unit, a 400-man battalion, was thought to have been detected in border areas of the South in late April 1965. Until the Tet Offensive in January 1968, according to Pentagon sources, North Vietnamese units, mainly drawing U.S. forces away from populated centers, were at about the level of Korean and Thai mercenaries who were terrorizing South Vietnam, all vastly outnumbered by the U.S. forces. By 1967, the war had reached such a level of devastation that, in Fall's words, Vietnam, as a cultural and historic entity, is threatened with extinction, as the countryside literally dies under the blows of the largest military machine ever unleashed on an area of this size. The strategy of destroying South Vietnam was generally considered a success. Harvard professor and government advisor Samuel Huntington concluded that, in an absent-minded way, the United States in Vietnam may well have stumbled upon the answer to wars of national liberation, namely, forced draft urbanization and mobilization by violence so extreme as to produce a massive migration from countryside to city, thus undercutting the Maoist strategy of organizing the peasant population, over 80% of the population when these techniques were initiated, and undermining the Viet Cong, a powerful force which cannot be dislodged from its constituency so long as the constituency continues to exist. The Tet Offensive of January 1968, conducted almost entirely by South Vietnamese NLF forces in cities and towns throughout the country, convinced U.S. elites that the war was proving too costly to the United States, and that strategy should shift toward a more capital-intensive operation with reliance on an indigenous mercenary army, in the technical sense of the phrase, and gradual withdrawal of U.S. forces, which were by then suffering a severe loss of morale, a matter of growing concern to military authorities. U.S. forces undertook a post-Tet accelerated pacification campaign, in actuality a mass murder operation that demolished the NLF and much of what was left of the peasant society while killing tens of thousands and extending the destruction of the country. Much of North Vietnam, particularly the southern region, was turned into a moonscape, and Laos was battered under the heaviest bombing in history, including the Peasant Society of Northern Laos, where the U.S. government conceded the bombing had no relation to its war in South Vietnam. The United States bombed and invaded Cambodia, destroying much of the countryside and mobilizing embittered peasants to the cause of the Khmer Rouge, previously a marginal force. By the war's end, the death toll in Indochina may have reached over 4 million or more, and the land and societies were utterly devastated. Subsequent U.S. policy has sought to prevent any recovery from this cataclysm by refusing reparations, aid, and trade, and blocking assistance from other sources. Although not all aid, U.S. aid to the Khmer Rouge in the 1980s appears to have run to many millions. Applying the principles that we rightly adopt in the case of Soviet aggression, the conclusion seems obvious. The United States attacked South Vietnam, arguably by 1962 and unquestionably by 1965, expanding its aggression to all of Indochina with lethal and long-term effects. Media coverage or other commentary on these events that does not begin by recognizing these essential facts is mere apologetics for terrorism and murderous aggression. The United States was defending South Vietnam in the same sense in which the Soviet Union is defending Afghanistan. But from the point of view of the media, or the culture, there is no such event in history as the U.S. attack against South Vietnam and the rest of Indochina. One would be hard-put to find even a single reference within the mainstream to any such event, or any recognition that history could possibly be viewed from this perspective, just as Pravda, presumably, records no such event as the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, only the defense of Afghanistan against bandits supported by the CIA. Even at the peak period of peace movement activism, there was virtually no opposition to the war within the intellectual culture on the grounds that aggression is wrong, the grounds universally adopted in the case of the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, for a very simple reason. The fact of U.S. aggression was unrecognized. There was much debate during the war over whether the North Vietnamese were guilty of aggression in Vietnam, and as we have seen, even the South Vietnamese were condemned for internal aggression, Adlai Stevenson, but there was no discussion of whether the United States was guilty of aggression in its direct attack against South Vietnam, then all of Indochina. These intriguing facts reflect the overwhelming dominance of the state propaganda system and its ability to set the terms of thought and discussion, even for those who believe themselves to be taking an adversarial stance. As for the media, departure from these doctrinal principles were negligible. Indeed, they may well have been literally zero in the vast coverage and commentary on the war, while it was in progress or since. In a revealing article entitled Lessons of Running Viet's War, published in August 1987, Stanley Carnell, a veteran Asia correspondent and author of a highly regarded liberal history of the Vietnam War, argues that the United States erred in Vietnam because it allowed the Vietnamese people to depend too heavily on us. Reciprocally, the South Vietnamese people also allowed themselves to be lulled into a complacent sense of dependency on the United States, thinking we wouldn't back down, not realizing that small clients are expendable. The South Vietnamese people who fought the U.S. invasion are never mentioned or considered to be South Vietnamese within Carnell's patriotic frame, although they constituted the majority of the population and the only serious political force, according to U.S. specialists and officials on the scene, and despite the fact that the U.S. selected faction repeatedly stressed that, frankly, we are not strong enough now to compete with the communists on a purely political basis. A Soviet Carnell would no doubt express similar concern in retrospect that the Soviet Union allowed the Afghans to rely too heavily on Soviet power. By the standards we rightly apply to the actions of the Soviet Union or other official enemies, there is nothing further that need be said about the media and Indochina. Any further discussion is on par with the minor question of whether Pravda reports facts accurately about the Soviet defense of Afghanistan. Adopting the Freedom House Trilateral Commission perspective, a Communist Party functionary might criticize Pravda for excessive pessimism or for too adversarial a stance, contributing to the eventual loss of the war and the takeover of Afghanistan by feudalist elements committed to terrorism, horrifying repression of women, religious fanaticism, plans to march on Jerusalem, etc. Or if he found that the reporting was sufficiently upbeat and not too distorted, he might laud Pravda for its accuracy and objectivity. But all of this would be nonsense, whatever is discovered. Serious evaluation of the media is effectively over when we discover that the basic principle of state propaganda, the principle that the USSR is defending Afghanistan from terrorist attack, is adopted as the unquestioned framework for further reporting and discussion. The same is true in the case of U.S. aggression in Indochina. We cannot quite say that the propaganda model is verified in the case of the Indochina wars, since it fails to predict such extraordinary, far-reaching, and exceptionless subservice to the state propaganda system. The fact that this judgment is correct, as it plainly is startling enough. Even more revealing with regard to Western intellectual culture is that the simple facts cannot be perceived, and their import lies far beyond the bounds of the thinkable. Nevertheless, let us pursue the narrow question of media coverage of Indochina, bearing in mind that we are now turning to relatively minor matters, having taken note of a central and quite devastating criticism: the media's pervasive, docile, and unthinking acceptance of a set of patriotic assumptions at such a level as to make further commentary of secondary significance at best. 5.3. The Early Stages: A Closer Look. The first Indochina war, fought by the French and their client forces and largely supplied by the United States, came to an end with the Geneva Accords of 1954, which established a partition at the 17th parallel pending reunification through election within 2 years. The United States pledged not to obstruct these arrangements. The Geneva settlement was quickly undermined by the United States and its client regime because it was taken for granted on all sides that elections would lead to a unified Vietnam under Viet Minh rule. American intelligence sources were unanimous that Diem, the U.S.-imposed client, would lose any national election, George Kahin concludes from a close inspection of the available record. The Viet Minh had agreed to the Geneva decision for regroupment of its forces well to the north of territories it controlled on the basis of the assurance that the struggle for the control of Vietnam would be transferred from the military to the political level, a realm in which the Viet Minh leaders knew their superiority over the French and their Vietnamese collaborators was even greater than it was militarily. For the Viet Minh, this was the heart of the Geneva agreements. The secret U.S. response to the perceived disaster of Geneva was a plan to resort to military action, including attacks on China if deemed necessary, in the event of local communist subversion or rebellion not constituting armed attack, in explicit violation of the U.N. Charter, which limits the use of force to self-defense in the event of armed attack until the U.N. Security Council is able to respond. This crucial decision, misrepresented beyond recognition in the Pentagon Papers history and generally ignored, also recommended operations against China, covert operations on a large and effective scale throughout Indochina, including North Vietnam, remilitarization of Japan, development of Thailand as the focal point for U.S. covert and psychological operations in Southeast Asia, etc. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara observed in a memorandum for President Johnson that only the U.S. presence after 1954 held the South together and enabled Diem to refuse to go through with the 1954 provision calling for nationwide free elections in 1956. Surveying the media during this period, Howard Elterman observes that during a 6-month period in 1955 and 1956, there was virtually no news coverage about the U.S. policy of undermining the Geneva Accords in the New York Times and the three newsweeklies. Communist charges to this effect were occasionally mentioned on back pages but dismissed as propaganda. Accurate propaganda, in fact. When the evasion of elections was conceded, it was justified on the basis of communist terror and regimentation. The Times, June 2, 1956, described Vietnam as a country divided into the communist regime in the north and a democratic government in the south, namely the murderous and corrupt Diem dictatorship. Newsweek denounced the wide infiltration in South Vietnam in support of the implacable purpose of the Viet Minh, while U.S. News and World Report condemned Ho Chi Minh for plotting new red aggression in Southeast Asia. More generally, through 1956, the press ensured that the reading public would view the war as a struggle between communism and the free world, Susan Welch observes on the basis of her survey of several leading journals. Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh were presented as merely agents of Moscow and Peking whose primary means of gaining support was through terror and force, although occasional mention was made of their nationalist appeal, while France was a gallant ally fighting alongside the United States to preserve liberty and justice in Asia, a cause carried on by the United States alone after Geneva. State doctrine was never challenged by editors or columnists. The liberal press showed particular enthusiasm for the cause, and news stories also reinforced the preconceptions of the administration, because the press relied almost completely on administration sources for information which was reported. Although coverage of Indochina was limited, apart from a peak in 1954, and faded still further afterwards, the terms of the future debate over U.S. policy were being hardened into usage by the press. With peaceful settlement successfully deterred, the United States and its client regime turned to the task of internal repression, killing tens of thousands and imprisoning tens of thousands more. Diem supporter and advisor Joseph Buttinger describes massive expeditions in 1956 that destroyed villages, with hundreds or thousands of peasants killed and tens of thousands arrested by soldiers in regions controlled by the communists without the slightest use of force, facts that were kept secret from the American people, and still are. The main target of the repression was the anti-French resistance, the Viet Minh, which was virtually decimated by the late 1950s. The reasons for the resort to violence were simple and have been amply documented. Recourse to violence was the only feasible response to the successes of the Viet Minh, reconstituted as the National Liberation Front, NLF, in organizing the peasantry, which left the United States only one option, to shift the struggle away from the political arena, where it was weak, to the arena of violence, where it was strong. Despite the U.S. organized terror, the Communist Party continued to advocate political action. The outline of strategy for the coming year sent to the South in late 1958 still called for political struggle without the use of arms. As Jeffrey Race documents, when the Communist Party finally authorized the use of violence in self-defense in 1959 in response to pleas from the Southern Viet Minh, the slaughter could no longer proceed unimpeded, and government authority quickly collapsed. Nevertheless, the government terrorized far more than did the revolutionary movement, for example, by liquidations of former Viet Minh by artillery and ground attacks on communist villages, and by roundups of communist sympathizers. The fundamental source of strength for the revolutionary movement, Race continues, was the appeal of its constructive programs, for example, the land reform program, which achieved a far broader distribution of land than did the government program, and without the killing and terror which is associated in the minds of Western readers with communist practices in land reform. On the contrary, the principal violence was brought about not by the party but by the government in its attempts to reinstall the landlords, the usual pattern, in fact, although not in the minds of Western readers. The lowest economic strata benefited the most from the redistributive policies implemented. Authority was decentralized and placed in the hands of local people, in contrast to the rule of the U.S. client regime, perceived as outside forces by major segments of the local population. What attracted people to the revolutionary movement was that it represented a new society in which there would be an individual redistribution of values, including power and status as well as material possessions. In Long An province near Saigon, which Race studied intensively, the NLF had become dominant in the early 1960s, while the government apparatus and its armed forces dissolved without violent conflict, undermined by NLF organizing and propaganda. By late 1964, parts of the province were declared a free strike zone, and by early 1965, revolutionary forces had gained victory in nearly all the rural areas of Long An. The first units of the North Vietnamese aggressors entered the province at the time of the 1968 Tet Offensive. In fact, up to summer 1969, when the post-Tet accelerated pacification campaign had succeeded in decimating the indigenous resistance, U.S. sources reported about 800 North Vietnamese against an estimated total of 49,000 Viet Cong soldiers and support troops in the entire Mekong Delta. This picture and what it entails was essentially invisible to the American public, and it is so remote from news coverage that sampling of the record is beside the point. The same remains true today outside of the specialist and dissident literature. The context of McNamara's observation cited earlier on the crucial U.S. role in blocking the election and unification provisions after Geneva was the growth of anti-war and neutralist sentiment in the Saigon-controlled areas in 1964. This came at a time when virtually all Vietnamese factions, along with international opinion generally, were seeking a political solution among Vietnamese that would head off the impending war to which the United States was committed because of its recognition that it had no political base in South Vietnam. The United States overturned the Diem regime in 1963 because of its ineptitude in conducting the war, as well as because the fears that it was moving toward a negotiated settlement with the NLF. There were few illusions about popular support for the U.S. efforts to maintain and extend the military struggle. As for the generals, who are all we have got, as Ambassador Lodge recognized in January 1964, U.S. policymakers knew little about them. William Bundy, soon to become Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs, later commented that, "Actually, no one on our side knew what the new people were thinking at all. Our requirements were really